on practice, we're doing concentration and meditation. So we decided to start with the beginning, concentration. Concentrate. Our first step to learning the philosophy of theosophy. Our continued endeavor to apply the philosophy of theosophy practically and altruistically so that the divine will may be made real. William Q. Judge authored insights frequently on this subject matter. For instance, what should be done is to realize that the master soul is one with all that implies, to know the meaning of the old teaching, thou art that. Live well your life, seek to realize the meaning of every event, strive to find the ever-living, and wait for more light. So concentrate. What comes to mind in the daily work of the kitchen is the handy reductions of juice, gravy, fruits, veg. With knowledgeable and persistent effort, the creative cook can take a multitude of unrelated substances, use the right conditions of heat and pressure, and then produce a new amalgam of the nutrition needed for future cooking. The original fresh produce is transformed into a product that can be preserved for future use to enhance the health of untold others as occasions permit or even demand. Concentrate. In the mind of the soul, using the human state, a similar practical effort can be created and sustained. With knowledgeable practice and increasing self-awareness, the student can gradually gather errant mind powers and thoughts, focus by self-induced and self-devised methods, and generate a new habit of one-pointedness or creative force with which to preserve the wisdom gained. The goal is to use that insight wisely as opportunities and duties arise in the future, in the moment. In the article Culture of Concentration, Robert Crosby defined concentration as the use of attention in the direction of anything we wish to do. He stressed that concentration should be used with consistency and persistently. Why? Because this is the most effective means of arriving at the full expression of soul powers and energies. William Q. Judge wrote his own article entitled Culture of Concentration, and in it he described that within each individualized human soul as Ishvara, a portion of the eternal spirit of all. That is the fount of all powers and energies available in life. For the spiritual rules the material. In daily life, prior to a soul becoming a seeker of truth, a student of the philosophy of theosophy is rooted in a civilization of distraction and distractibility. Multitasking is valued and even advised. Sensory overload and stimulation from the environment may hold sway because passions and desires can run amok. In the practical theosophical life, the student is told that while Ishvara is the basis of the eternal pilgrim, the promise of buddhi-manas becomes dual upon incarnation into the various skandhas created by the soul. As such, mind has natural tendencies to fly off any matter that's being considered, that's being focused on. The lower mind, the desire mind, if you will, is attracted to pleasant or unpleasant memories, or even to passivity and idleness. It is the effort to harness these lower tendencies that are so invigorated, shall we say, by our civilization. It is the effort to quell that monkey mind, to correct the use of mind that establishes a practice or a process of developing the powers of concentration, often called Raj Yoga, or the union of the spiritual with the psychic and the physical. A union where one pointedness remains spiritual. First, there is the need to understand the true nature of humankind in general, as well as in particular within the individual incarnation at hand. Gradually, the student focuses on the fact of the true self and the use of the higher mind from which flows all powers. The identification with and the concentration on the derivative transitory tendencies of the body and the personality is at last broken. The spell is broken. Clear insight is established. The student blooms where planted. Second, in the practice of controlling the use of mind, the awareness comes that the habits of the lower mind spring from an internal organ capable of being the distractor itself. Gradually, all the principles being used by soul in the human state, affecting the use of concentration, are harnessed. We have a phrase, to raise the self, the personal self, by the self, the higher self, the self of all. Gradually, what is awoken is the highest of the astral senses. As a contemplative book, The Voice of the Silence instructs, the mind is the great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer. The disciple is soul, the power to think, and as such is the eternal pilgrim, the real man that can be liberated from the ties of karma. The control must be achieved and maintained, and again, that effort is by that soul in a particular physicality, a personality, if you will. Third, as the endeavor to concentrate is established and sustained, distracting and destructive hindrances like anger, envy, vanity, and fear can be dissipated. Idle fancy and racing thoughts from the astral can be diminished. The astral or design body registers all the aspirations to concentrate, the motives behind that endeavor, and the cycles of past impressions from the misuses of those hindrances. As the effort to remain calm and focused in mindfulness in the moment continues, the disruptors lose their power. The magnetic attraction that drew them is diminished and then fully neutralized. The focused, concentrated mind used by the enlightened or the masterful ones can assume the shape and perceive the history of an object or of a people or of a world. At the stage of the novice student seeker of truth, concentration gradually makes the body subservient to the thinking principle. The brain is said to become porous in order that the highest of insights, intuition, inspiration, can be expressed. In the Bhagavad Gita is found the instructions that are needed so that the tumblers of the locks on the spiritual powers resident in the human soul can be aligned. When those tumblers are aligned, freedom may be achieved. True concentration will bloom on the basis of the desire to make union with the higher self of all, with each and all, in a full application of Raj Yoga. That union is the nucleus of universal brotherhood. Concentration is said to be the first of all powers. Each incarnation is the opportunity to be the instrument or the agent of the divine will. Will is universal force. Behind will stands desire. the fewer desires held, the more concentrated the life, the greater the bloom or the outcome. Just as the cook in the kitchen, the student can gather a myriad of experiences, bring the light of a kind heart and the force of a fine mind to the endeavor, and then extract the finest outcomes to be preserved for use in the salvation of one and all, as karmic conditions permit and demand.
Thank you. So we just heard, about what is concentration, and considering that this month's overall topic is practical theosophy, so what does concentration and meditation have to do with things being practical? And when we look at this idea of the practice of meditation, what does theosophy say and how does it explain it? So theosophy, well, HPB provided basically no direction when it came to actual practice of meditation, although she did occasionally mention it, but as a subject, but it seemed as though she left it mostly to Mr. Judge in order to discuss what meditation is and concentration. But theosophy definitely encourages folks to meditate, and we'll discuss why. And then if there's any questions after the panel, then we can certainly entertain them. But one of the things that is discouraged is this idea of guided meditation and group meditation, because nowadays it's very popular, but most serious students of theosophy view such practices as undesirable, because real progress, not only in meditation, but in regards to just a spiritual progress, has to be made by oneself. We are not looking to an outside God for any guidance. We're not looking to priests or rabbis or anything like that. Everything has to come from within. As was said in the first talk, we're looking at self-induced and self-devised means. And some of the guided meditations verge on hypnosis, and it puts a person into a passive state, which we speak of frequently in theosophy, that being passive is not what we want. And with meditation, as well as concentration, it is, and we'll get to this in a moment, about why being passive is not the state of choice. It can be harmful. And also with group meditation, there is that possibility of what is known as psychic contagion, where there's a mingling of elementals, good and bad, between the people that are in the group. So Plato expressed meditation as a silent, unuttered prayer. He also made a comment that the ardent turning of the soul towards the divine, not to ask anything particularly good, as common prayer often will, but for good itself, for the universal supreme good of which we are a part on the earth and out of the essence. Can you please mute? And out of the essence of which we have all emerged. And that's from H.P. Blavatsky in The Key to Theosophy. So can we see a difference between meditation and concentration? And it seems as though with concentration, we're learning how to focus. We are learning to look towards the higher. And sometimes with concentration, we are concentrating on a specific idea, a specific topic. And it's training the mind to focus on one task, which is needed in meditation. Meditation focuses on higher thoughts. Now, how do we go about meditating? I mean, that's a big question people ask when they come to Theosophy. And Mr. Judge talks about setting apart a specific time for meditation. This forms a habit. And a habit, as the time comes around, the mind will after a while become trained to that time. If one picks just the morning to meditate, when one wakes up, that they realize that that is what they're supposed to do. And it will become natural. And as he put it, hence it will be well for you to keep the same hour as far as possible. And that's from letters that have helped me. But he also warns us that we will have to give up something. And he talks, and we'll quote this because it has a little bit of humor to it. He goes, to wit, have yourself called half an hour earlier than is usual. Devote it before breakfast to silent meditation in which brood upon all great and high ideas. This is an exclamation mark. Half an hour. Surely you can spare. And don't eat first. If you can take another half before you go to bed, and without any preliminaries of undressing or making things agreeable or more comfortable, meditate again. Don't fail me in this. This is much to give up, but give it up, recollecting that you are not to make all those preparations so often indulged by people. The best and most important teacher is one seventh principle, which is spirit centered in the sixth, which is Buddhi. The more you divest yourself of the illusionary sense of personal isolation, and the more you are devoted to the services of others, the more Maya disappears and nearer you approach to divinity. And that's also from letters that have helped me. So we have learned what the power of concentration is. And the greatest help will now come to you from concentrating upon the higher self and aspire towards that higher self. Also, if you will take some subject or sentence from the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of our meditation books, it does really help for us to focus our mind. But there are much advice that is given by adepts. And It is every day and as often as you can, and ongoing to sleep as you wake. Think, think, think on that truth that you are not the body, brain, or astral man, but you are that in capital letters, and that is the supreme soul. So there is an idea in theosophy called a lifetime's meditation, where one will carry through in all their actions, all their thinking, everything that they do has a spiritual higher purpose. And that will carry one through from the time they wake up until they go to sleep. And it is said that if we see the self in all things, no matter what, then fear will pass away in time. And again, it's suggested that we use, study, and meditate on the ideas from the Bhagavad Gita. And Mr. Judge says that's a book that has done me more good than all others in the whole range of books. And it can be studied all the time. One can just kind of open it up and find something to focus on. For one who watches his thoughts and acts so as to perform those that ought to be done. And again, the Bhagavad Gita talks about doing one's duty as it comes to them. So whatever comes to us is karmically what we have been given. So this is what it means about to perform those that ought to be done. And it will increase that power of real meditation. And we have to remember that real meditation is not blanking your mind out. It's not finding a spot on the wall and focusing on that. What real meditation is focusing, concentrating on a higher thought, whether it be the masters, whether it be the universe, anything of a higher nature, some of the readings from the Bhagavad Gita, the voice of the silence, we can focus on that. And it is those higher thoughts that will help us in our daily lives with that life's meditation. So it does require thought and mental effort, being persistent and have faith that it will work. But staring at spots on the wall and blanking one's mind is not what is considered to be true meditation. So, as was mentioned in the first talk, whenever we begin to meditate, little things, I like to call it a hamster in a wheel, going around and around and around, will happen. But we have to stop that little creature from taking over our minds. So if we're in the middle of meditating on a subject and that hamster intrudes, we kick him out and tell him no. And then we bring back in that specific topic that we were trying to focus on. So one of the things Mr. Judge also says is that if we remember that the very essence of our being, the inmost sanctuary of the soul, is divine, we can enter into it and shut out the evil. So it's not easy to overcome these errant thoughts that happen, but the more we do it, the more they won't intrude. And then we can continue to focus on what is the higher nature of our soul. And it is the tendency, especially in this day and age, it is the tendency of the mind to wander. Multitasking, as was mentioned, has been, and especially depending upon what your job is or was, multitasking has been encouraged. And in reality, it is not healthy for the brain to do that. And the Bhagavad Gita says, to whatsoever object the inconstant mind goeth out, he should subdue it, bring it back, and place it upon the spirit. So we're looking at the spirit to focus on. We're looking at the masters. So there's many higher ideas that we can use. And we are considered to be part of the all. And that is the that is a subject of meditation and will bring the best and most rapid progress. We can fix our thoughts on the elder brothers, work for them, serve them, and they will help through the right appropriate means and no other. To meditate on the higher self is difficult. Seek then the bridge, the masters. And again, that's Mr. Judge's letters that have helped me. We can also read the voice of the silence and meditate on its sayings. And we have a lot of intellectual stuff that we can use, but we need to be devotional at the same time. For what is desirable is the awakening of the spiritual consciousness, the intuition, or buddhi. This cannot be done unless thoughts are turned that way with power and purpose. And this is what meditation is, the turning towards towards buddhi, spiritual consciousness, the intuition, by using, and we can use those meditation books, those spiritual books that we've mentioned, the Voice of the Silence and the Bhagavad Gita. So we would like just to end, we know we've gone on, meditate upon the masters exclusively. Try to reach up to them in thought. If you find the mind has strayed, bring it back again to the subject of meditation. The mind will stray more or less at first, and perhaps for a long time to come, but do not be discouraged at the apparent results if unsatisfactory to your mind. The real results may not at once be apparent, but the work is not lost. We know Madame Blavatsky always talked about, don't worry about failing, just get up and do it again. The work is not lost, even though not seen. It is more than likely that the work in this direction will be perceived by others rather than yourselves. Never mind the past, for you are at the entrance of a new world to you as persons. You have set your feet on the path that leads to real knowledge. So we will take any questions.
There's one back there.
Theosophy Hall in the back.
So the statements were made It was stressed how important it is when we meditate to do so with a particular or a universal focus, a focus on a universal something, but not to blank our mind in one hand and not to join in like a mass meditation, being told to what to meditate on. In this last few sentences, the statement was made to meditate on the masters. What does that mean?
So what does it mean to meditate on the masters? Well, the masters have been where we are now. They have, over the course of all their lives, they have made the same mistakes. They have made progress as we hope we will be. And we can meditate on how they have worked over their lives, the many lives that they have had, and that by thinking of them, meditating on them, we can follow in their path. So do you?
Yeah, when in the philosophy, when we read about masters, what's going on is information that across the eons, across all ages, places, peoples, there have arisen incredibly enlightened, unfettered souls. And they're known by many, many different names. The Christ, the Buddha, you know, Krishna. You can go into any particular culture and read the accounts of these fully enlightened ones. So envisioning any one of them or all of them, and then beginning to extrapolate what would it be to be a radiant of the absolute unknowable source of all, and to exist and use that radiance and those powers in order to uplift all of humanity and all of manifestation. So whereas the Christians say they have a unique Messiah, a unique master, theosophy would say there's nothing unique under the sun. Rather, there's an example of one enlightened soul, and we can use those exemplars as ideals and reals to envision, to think about, to plan, to aspire to how to use our lives altruistically as any one of these great enlightenment enlightened entities might. SL was
SL.
Is the act of concentration and meditation a purely subjective one, one that relates only to one's internal spiritual development? Or do those very acts have a beneficial karmic effect on those around us, directly or indirectly, or on the lives that are within the lower kingdoms of nature?
Well, we think it's subjective, but the progress that each individual will make can affect that progress being made from the concentration and meditation. Though that can affect by seeing our improvement, that we are helping others, that they can see how we have changed, and it can affect others as well.
There's also a metaphysical aspect to that consideration. If we consider the fact that even in the medical sciences, we are now very alert to the human state being an electromagnetic entity, force generator of fields and vibrations. And if we consider that there is this incredibly spiritual aspect to the process of listening to the sounds another emits, receiving that stimuli, converting it into a meaningful internal experience, processing that intellectually, and then readmitting sound in response. All that is instantaneous. And we know that as we generate thought in conversation and in groups, how we use sound, voice, tone, volume, etc., we can greatly affect everyone around us. Well, philosophically, what the theosophy proposes is that we consider that thoughts are points of energy, a degree of a life force that we create and infuse with energy, and that these are transmitted, that each of us is a small transmitting scenario, and that as we generate thought, as we hold thought, as we intensify thought, as we hone our desires and aspirations, we people the psychic atmosphere, the astral, with whatever those thoughts and energies were. So yes, we can bring physical comfort to our companions as we improve our own character and develop ethics and morality and altruism. But in the very essence of meditating, concentrating and meditating, we actually are transmitting and attracting magnetically kindred spirits, other souls. We're uplifting the whole. And this is not just for the human state. There's plenty of scientific investigation on the role of thought and sound and emotions and that affect on vegetation and lower life forms. So there's a lot that you can look into. Don't believe or accept anything you're hearing, but look around at the world and see what the implications are of some of the research.
And Mr. Judge in The Ocean of Theosophy talks about how the human brain is a dynamo. And that, as was just said, the way we think and the way we put out any kind of communication to others, the thinking, the thoughts, all are powerful, and it can affect all those around us. So by meditating and concentrating on a regular basis, we can change the dynamic of those thoughts and put them out in a more positive way into the astral.
Chat?
Is this a comment on what we're talking about now?
That's about the masters, is that okay?
Okay.
So if we think about masters as ideals and facts, we may never meet them in the flesh, but they've been well documented over and over again. And it's said that the present humanity is such that, just like in a group meditation, we're open to other elements and pollution. They, in a sense, are better off working behind the scene than in person because of the state of the world as it is. But we need to think of the fact that we are perfectible, and they have perfected themselves up to the limit of perfectibility in this period of evolution. There's future perfectibility in a sense, and other in future periods of evolution, but they have achieved absolute perfection of their seven principles. So we're not poor, miserable sinners. We're, albeit struggling and imperfect now, but the goal is
We are perfectible. We can get beyond this, can we not?
Yes, we are perfectible, and that is definitely something that can be meditated on. So we will try our look at our chat. Space. There are many meditation techniques. What about meditating on mantras?
There are many techniques, and there's a tiny ancient book called Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, in which there are guiding statements about posture and the setting of a room and the nature of the atmosphere in the room, the how-tos, if you will. There are many folks around the world that use mantras or chants in the Catholic Church, and they use rosary beads and the repetition of particular words with each one of those beads. There are worry beads used in cultures where people mutter while they finger these worry beads. These are techniques of perhaps beginning to focus the mind. But if that's the only sustained effort to meditate, if there is a self-hypnotic trance-like state that is achieved by the repetition of sound, perhaps by movements, the whirling dervishes are folks that go into a dance maneuver and repeat it over and over and over again. Those kind of repetitive uses of the physical senses and the physical body induce passivity. They induce a trance-like status where the lower mind becomes vacated and where the psychic senses potentially are opened like an open door, and whatever forces of the unknown psychic lower elements are available can rush in and take over. So the philosophy would advise, and again, look at Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms for advice, but if you know your physical body and know your physical brain and personality, and set up those circumstances periodically, perhaps the same time in the morning, the same time at night, and go through a mild routine of putting the body into a relaxed, comfortable state. Maybe it's a few deep breaths. Maybe it's considering a particular item of poetry or listening to a little bit of music, something to calm the physical and begin to focus the mind and the heart, and then begin with a seed idea. And plenty of advice has been given this morning of that seed idea that you could consider and use reason and intellectual prowess, certainly, to consider the idea from a variety of different points of view, and to consider the seed idea and how it practically might be used in daily life to alleviate the suffering of someone. And there you have your launching place. Consciously, cognitively, you're concentrated, you're focused, you're calm, and there's a one-pointedness on the subject matter, even if it's intellectual. But as my compadre said earlier, the lower mind and the personality being what it may be, whether you consider it a little monkey or a gerbil or a hamster, whatever it is, that constant habitual movement of the lower mind, fanciful ideas, a list of fretting over, oh my gosh, I've got so much to do today, tomorrow, the next 4 weeks. That kind of distractor will try to creep in. You can extinguish it with practice. Be aware of it, be conscious of the lower mind, perhaps consider what triggered that concept, and then move your mind back again to the seed idea and start again. we've got a hand.
JB.
Yeah, we've got two hands. One, go ahead.
Yeah, JB.
Yeah, hi. An interesting idea that was mentioned in the first panel was the misuse of hindrances. And I think that was mentioned in relation to karma. Could you elaborate on what that means, the misuse of hindrances, if I understand that correct?
Oh, yeah. The list of hindrances is given a variety of different places in the philosophy. And they're listed as basically emotional states, if you will. And I'll be darned if I can find them right this minute. Oh, here they are. Anger is said to be the most destructive of all, but envy, vanity, and fear are the kinds of hindrances. These are lines of thought, of fancy, of the lower mind that can come in and invade and take over. And we find folks can be misuse them. They become obsessed with the anger, the hostility, the resentment, or they become completely focused on revenge, or they might be completely overwhelmed by a fear or lack of confidence or the worry and anxiety about something that's coming at them. Others might be completely focused and energizing thought of envying others. And in that way, the hindrance is habitual, it's karmic, it's rooted in the past impressions we've created and engendered with energy. It comes back again. We can misuse it, become obsessed with it, can become lost in it, and lose our concentration on spiritual. The proper use would be, in addition to those two moments of seated meditation, morning and night, the proper use would be a lifetime's endeavor in the daily life as duties arrive, to be aware in the moment and to be mindful, to be centered, to be concentrated. So if we find a hindrance arising, we find in the moment we're feeling a degree of anger or hostility or resentment or impatience, or we find in the moment that we've suddenly got this sense physically, emotionally, of some kind of fear, the proper use of the hindrance is to be pause, power is in the pause, retreat a little bit, become aware of that sensation of the hindrance, and then stop and consider, I am soul. I'm feeling this. What triggered it? How did it be triggered? How can I offset it? Take away all energy or force from the hindrance and move the mind, concentrate the mind on dissolving that hindrance or using it to learn how to better communicate in the moment or to observe an old pattern of cycles of impressions and to diffuse them and to calm them. So that would be the proper use of concentrated mind and heart, using the hindrances as they arrive. Let's face it, if the ancient teachings propose that mind and soul and the spiritual have been in communion for over 18 million years, each entity, each reincarnating soul has buckets of karma, of past impressions that we've engendered. Those forces are coming back at us as the correct karmic conditions experience. So the hindrances are going to arrive. Where we are as novices, we're not masterful. We're not enlightened. We're not unfettered. We're going to experience these very natural things. And the trick, the magic, is to remain aware, concentrated, and calm enough that we can see the illusion for what it is and then rise above it and do better. Oh, there's a hand here, and then we'll get
to MDW.
MW. Yeah.
I have a question about, and actually it ties in very well with hindrances, because I'm thinking about meditation, thinking about how manifesting is very much, it's a big word right now that people really like using, and it seems very extractive in practice, but it almost seems like a lustful hindrance in our meditation.
Well said. The entire issue of manifesting good fortune is not brand new. I mean, if you go back into the history of some of the Christian churches, John Calvin's establishment of Protestantism, they measured grace and blessedness and salvation in their ability to accrue wealth and well-being. And there are certainly practitioners today in a variety of sects that do that. And then there's the great multitude of folks that psychologically, they're aware that we do have these psychic powers. We do have the possibility of spiritual powers. And you're right, that hindrance of lust, of aggrandizement, of avarice, of I, me, mine, of imagining and magically bringing about some sort of materialistic success for the personal, for the physical, for just that one individual. Is that possible? The philosophy says there are very natural and normal scientific reasons why that's possible, very, very possible. But equally, as you just said, it's lustful. It's the lowest dregs of desires. So why use spiritual powers in that so finite, limited a way? It's very, very destructive. Thank you.
And both of the speakers mentioned how we need to focus on positive things. And the whole manifesting, it's like praying. You're praying for something. Whereas with meditation, you're focusing on spirit, not something. And MDW's had his hand up for a while.
And then we're done.
Well,
we have a whole few 30 seconds, but on Wednesday night, we've been talking about this. It's rather ironic that, you know, the imagination is what they call a constructor in the workshop of nature, so that with our imagination, we can create a better world. You know, and that's why, again, you know, through meditation and concentration, but not only seeing the masters, but within us, that the potential lies within us, so that we can imagine ourselves as being better.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And unfortunately, we're done.
Yeah, our time is up. But Wednesday night, we will be discussing psychic and spiritual powers at the loftiest point of what's able and willing and available to each of us as soul. Have a great week.
See you soon.